What's happening today with virtual reality technology? That's the topic today on Mind Matters News.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. I recently bought an Oculus Quest VR system and it blew me away. There's only four pieces. There's a headset, two hand units, and there's also a recharger. And the experience was so real, I got shaky knees just looking down into an abyss in a Star Wars game. We've been talking to Tom Furness about that, and he said that pilots that first witnessed his virtual reality had similar sort of experiences. For the Oculus Quest, the roller coaster ride that I went on was so real, I had difficulty just standing still. You want to fall over. And the boxing was so real, both my wife and future daughter-in-law could not continue with the game because the boxing opponent looked so fierce. It's real and it's scary stuff. In the beginning of virtual reality, as we've talked in subsequent or previous podcasts, in the beginning of VR was Dr. Tom Furness, and he's our guest today on Mind Matters News. Dr. Furness has been dubbed the grandfather of virtual reality because of his pioneering work in the field. Dr. Furness is a professor in the Department of Industrial and Systems Engineering in Seattle at the University of Washington. Dr. Furness, welcome back.
Thank you, Bob. It's always good to continue the journey with you.
I have been learning so much about the history. This has been a lot of fun. One of the things you did at the University of Washington is you founded the HIT Lab. Now, lest our listeners become concerned, this is not a organization for murder incorporated.
Although we thought about that in the past.
did you? The HIT Lab stands for the Human Interface Technology Lab. And Dr. Furness also has HIT Labs at the University of Canterbury and the University of Tasmania. He has 27 startup companies, and two of them have capitalization of over $12 billion, and two of his companies are traded on NASDAQ. And we wanted to talk about that today. What's the cutting edge of virtual reality technology? What are some of these things that have come out of the HIT Lab? So, Dr. Furness, I'll turn it over to you. I don't know where you want to start. I have some specific questions, but tell us some of the technology which has come out in your startup companies.
You bet. Well, certainly what we are trying to do is embrace this whole idea of the push and the pull of technology. I mean, for many years, virtual reality and augmented reality were in push mode. Basically, the whole idea, if you build it, they will come. That the technology was developing, we knew from the early days, especially the military days, it was profound in terms of the power it had. But what could we do to get it out of the military to where it could be used in not only vertical markets on the outside, consumer markets and industrial markets, but how could we could solve real problems with it? And so you have the push of the technology and you have the pull of the applications. And how do you make these work together? Well, as in an earlier segment, actually the first segment, we talked about that actually VR emerged from, at least from my work in it, beginning in 1966, emerged as a result of trying to solve problems in military aviation. And as a result of the process of solving those problems, we invented what we know today as virtual reality. And we found over the years what a profound impact it has on the way people think. And as I transitioned from the military to a university environment, we started looking across different domains and how this technology might be applied. Now, one of the beginning things that happened was that when I showed up in 1989, very few people knew what virtual reality was, that it existed or what it was. And so, we decided maybe we should try to introduce a device into the consumer marketplace. And working with some of my colleagues, even before arriving at in Seattle, we came up with what we call a personal eyewear display. And this looked like ski goggles that you would wear. And what it would be is basically a virtual display, a head-up type display that would display for over one eye a virtual screen. It appeared 1 meter, 3 meters away and about 1 meter wide. It's sort of like a home theater system that you wear on your head. And it would plug into this little battery pack with a television receiver hooked around your waist. And we started working on this, and a patent was issued in the early 90s. And we started a company called Virtual Vision to make these. And indeed, we did. And we raised a bunch of money and started building these devices. And so this was a really simple display in that we just took a liquid crystal screen that was rear illuminated, and then we project it down to a prism that you would look through, and you'd see this virtual image, but you'd also see the outside world around it. And so it didn't replace the outside world. It was just sort of a small piece that you saw or again appeared out in the outside world. And so you could sit on Waikiki Beach and watch the NFL playoffs if you wanted to with this device, with broadcast television. And so we introduced this, actually the first opening of this product. We took it to the Consumer Electronics Show, and people were lined up for 2 hours to see this thing. And they'd take a look at it.
What year was this?
This was in 94, 95 time period.
Okay.
And they would say, oh gosh, this is amazing. This is transformative. You guys are going to make a fortune. And we started saying to ourselves, we're going to make a fortune. And we started believing our press. And so what happened?
That can be very dangerous.
It can be dangerous. That's right. So we ramped up. We were producing these things, and they appeared in the marketplace. We had a big advertisement on the New York Times and all this. And indeed, people would show up and line up outside of Magnolia Hi-Fi, which was the first place where we introduced it. We had the network television people were there, and the big introduction, and people would go in, put it on, and say, wow, this is really neat. I want one of these things. And they looked at the price tag.
Oh.
And it was $799. That was back in 95, you know, this is 94. That was a pretty steep bill. And by the way, we weren't making any money at that price point. But, you know, the technology was still pretty archaic at that time. So what happened was that people didn't buy them. They wanted to buy them, but it would just cost too much. And so we were disappointed in that. But then we started seeing there was one market segment that was buying these things like crazy. We said, what's going on here? And we tracked it down, and there were dentists. Dentists were buying this virtual vision display. And we went and visited the dentist and saying, what's going on? And they showed us what they were doing is they were giving these to their patients. So the patients would put them on. They would select a movie, plug it into the VCR, play this into the headset. And there they were in the dentist chair. And they were watching this video or this movie while the dentists were inflicting pain on them, you know. And the dentist said, the patients love it. And we love it because they don't complain anymore. You know, they are watching this movie. They're sort of zoned out in their own space. And they said, however, it is creating another problem. Now we can't get them to leave. You know, I can't leave now. This is a good part. You know,
they didn't finish the movie, of course.
That's right. But even more remarkable than that was the children. They would have these small kids in, and they'd hook this up to Nintendo. And so here the kids were playing Nintendo with his headset on, with a virtual, the headset on, and sitting in a dentist chair while the dentists were doing the thing. And usually the kids are terrified and they don't want to be there. And so these kids loved it. And they'd go home and talk to their mothers, Mommy, when can I go back to the dentist again so I can see this special glasses? And so when did that ever happen? When did kids ever say they want to go back to the dentist? But the dentists were saying, you know, it seems like they don't notice the pain when there is some, because they're distracted. And we're saying, that's interesting. So then we contacted some of our colleagues at Seattle Children's Hospital to see if this pain thing really was relevant, especially with leukemia patients. These little patients are really sick, and the way that you determine the efficacy of the treatment, which is basically chemotherapy, they would have to extract bone marrow and look at what was going on with the white count and in the blood marrow. And this is a really painful procedure. You put a needle in the hip and extract the bone marrow, and the children would just scream. It's so painful. And they're so sick, you can't anesthetize them. And so this was what was happening. And we went into the hospital with our equipment. Again, it was connected with Nintendo. And these kids would be going through this procedure, but they're playing Nintendo at the time. And the doctor would put the needle in, and the kid would make a little, say, oomph or something like that, and just continue to play the game. And the nurses and doctors were looking at each other saying, what's going on here? You know, and it's like they didn't even notice it. And that set us on a whole different track of what we're doing with these virtual displays. We said, wow, what's happening is, in order to experience pain, you have to be conscious of pain. But if you're doing something else that is engaging, then you don't notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to the Harborview Burn Center. This is one of the regional burn clinics where these patients are severely burned, and they are doped up with morphine most of the time. So when the morphine can control the so-called rest pain when you're just lying in the bed in semi-agony, but the morphine can control that. But morphine isn't good. You know, it's toxic. It's addictive. It's pretty bad stuff. And when they went in for wound care to remove staples from skin grafts or to do physical therapy, or they would soak the patients in these tubs of water and then slough off the dead skin, anytime that happened, the pain would shoot through the roof. You couldn't dose them with enough morphine because it's what is called breakthrough pain. It would break right through that. So we started introducing VR to the burn clinic. And the patients, again, would put on a headset, and we built a virtual world where they'd be flying in a, basically in snow. They would be in a snow canyon, and they would be snowmen. They're throwing snowballs at them when they're flying through this canyon. And they would throw snowballs back at the snowmen. And this was all going on during the time that they were receiving this treatment. And then we'd ask them for a pain index. And what would happen is the patient will say, well, when are you going to start?
Really?
When, in fact, you'd finished the procedure.
What is a pain index? Is that where they ask you, like, tell me on a scale of 1 to 10 what
yes.
the pain's like?
Yes.
I see. Okay.
And this is a well-established pain scale. I mean, that, and it, they talk about what do you feel when you're at this particular number. And usually, you know, with breakthrough pain, it's just off the scale. Rest pain is maybe 2 or 3. But then when they were in VR, the pain went from 10 to 0. And then we ask them the unpleasantness of the pain, the feeling of presence in it, all these kinds of things. And we thought, well, this is amazing, but it only worked once. You know, you put them in this world, it would, after they get used to it, it's not going to work. We were wrong. Exactly the opposite. It gets better with time, as they get it. And furthermore, they remember being in that world. And we're now finding out that's a big factor in chronic pain. These other things were acute pain during wound care. But in chronic pain, with rheumatoid arthritis, things like that, it even works there because of the model that the people build in their head. So what this did, this early work, is it set us off on an altogether different track of an application for VR. And now VR is being used worldwide in hospitals. Not only for treating things like burn pain or acute pain, but also for in pediatric clinics. And we're actually using it. We have a project with the Make-A-Wish Foundation where we're actually making wishes for these kids who are terminally ill to help them with giving them something to do. in VR. So the impact on medicine just from the pain standpoint is huge, not to mention the diagnostics, the simulator training, and things like that. So in my HIT lab, we had a major project going on in looking at medical applications of VR, including the pain work, also for surgery simulation to train surgeons. Amazing what happens there. In the case of, for example, urology, where there is going to be a procedure called the transurethral resection of the prostate. That's when you go in and carve away part of the prostate that's restricting urine flow in the urethra.
Ah.
And this is a painful process. It can be a painful process, and you don't want to mess it up because that can change your will to live, you know what I mean. And so what would happen is the doctors that are learning, the residents, they only have a limited amount of time to practice this procedure. And over a period of 3-year residency, they could only maybe do a total of maybe 30 or 40 procedures on real patients. And of course, most of these patients are going to be normal. Nothing unusual happens. But with our simulator that we built in conjunction with the UW Medical Center, University of Washington Medical Center, these residents could do 50 procedures a day. And with all kinds of variations.
Wow.
With things that would happen, with bleeders and things like that. And all, what it is flight simulator. It's like the pilots train. We're having the surgeons train the same way. And this has been done with sinus surgery simulation, with suturing simulation, training medical students. And so this is a boon for training, especially medical training. So here again is we have an application pull that's come from this.
Well, you can see from your illustration the need for this cross-curricular sort of approach to things.
Yes.
You need the psychology, the medicine, you need the art, you need cultural anthropology, you need all of these different disciplines because they all contribute.
That's right. And you know, no single discipline owns virtual reality because it cuts across. It is basically, it's all aspects of building tools for humans to work in the world. And just like everybody uses wheels, you know, so it's that kind of thing. It's a ubiquitous kind of technology. Now, to jump around a little bit, certainly we were working on these applications, but again, we had to get the technology to keep up with the need.
Mm-hmm.
And up to this point in time, we were building displays that started off with some kind of image plane, or what we call an object plane, where an image was formed, and then we relay that image to the eyes some way. But you had to start off with this object plane. So it's a little screen in case of the, for example, the virtual vision display I just mentioned, a very small screen. And then you magnify and you project it so it appears to be a big screen. But the problem is, you're really limited in how many picture elements you can put in that small screen.
Yes.
And especially at high luminance. So there had to be a change in the way we did it. And so this is where we got into this whole idea of why are we having to start off with an object plane to begin with? Why don't we scan the image directly on the retina of the eye? And so we started working on this concept of a virtual retinal display, where you start off with a coherent beam of light from a micro laser, very low energy laser, and then you scan it such that the screen is the retina of the eye. That's the only place where an image exists, is by scanning the photons across the surface of the retina. Very low energy. As a matter of fact, it's lower energy than what you get outside when you walk out in daylight. And what you now see is an image that doesn't exist, and is very high resolution, very wide field of view, high luminance, as a matter of fact, as high luminance as you want it to be, and you know you could probably run the thing with a hearing aid battery. So this direct retinal projection was transformative.
You know, the biggest objection I hear today about virtual reality is the clunky headsets. This is an answer to that, isn't it?
It is. It is indeed. And so what we did with this, this was at the time, we patented this, and we have several patents, and we had a company that wanted to license it. And that company was Microvision. And Microvision licensed it from the university. At the time, it was the largest license deal the University of Washington ever done.
Uh-huh.
And it was, you know, it was a huge license fee. I think it was $5.133 million, a 9% equity in the company, a 2.5% royalty stream with a minimum that was promised. And Microvision started making these things, and then they went public and turned the university stock into something that was really worth a lot. And now they still exist, and they're one of the companies traded on NASDAQ.
I see. Where can I get one of these? I want to get rid of my clunky headset.
Well, it's not. That's the thing. You know, right now, the you can't get it because it's not being used. It was being used by the military for a while. And now that engine is now being used for head-up displays in cars, and because it has such can have such high luminance. But it is certainly the wave of the future. Now, the company Magic Leap started out using this concept, the technology, and actually a variation of it was done by the Google Glass. And so it will come again into that into the world because it's got to be the way to go in terms of getting rid of the clunky headset.
Well, let me ask you about Google Glass. I think that they kind of went away. I don't hear much about them anymore. But they probably had something to do with your ski goggles and your virtual retinal display, or did they?
Well, they were related, and it was very small field of view. And, of course, the problem with the Google Glass was the technology worked. It worked, and it worked pretty well. The problem was the social aspect of it. No one really realized what that was going to do. When you're talking to a person and they have this Google Glass on, and you don't know if they're paying attention to you or they're paying attention to what's being displayed in the Google Glass. And people started, you know, are you taking pictures of me? Are you taking images of me? Which it could do, by the way. And so this became, you know, that was something they never really did get into at the time. Now, Google Glass is a resurgence, and again, better designs, but it's now being used in vertical markets. These are where people absolutely have to have this in order to do their job. And so that's different. That's an all the different marketplace than what where Google originally introduced this.
I see.
So there is a big deal about now that you're wearing these glasses, and these glasses display information, and you're now interacting with another human being, and they know that you're wearing these glasses, but they don't know what you're seeing. Are they, you know, somehow psychoanalyzing you while they're looking at you? You know, you just don't know. So,
you know, I feel that way, Tom, when I talk to a psychologist, a professor in psychology, I talk to him and I think, is he analyzing me?
Yeah.
Same thing, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I get that with my wife, you know, anytime I talk to her about it.
Yeah, ditto.
So anyhow, the virtual retinal display became one of our mainstream devices that we were working on in the lab, developing the technology. We had this big project funded by Microvision. But here's what happened. We had one of our lab units, our bench top units, optical bench unit, where we were displaying this image that's on your retina. So we'd have people who'd come in could see it and see how it works. And so there's one guy that came in, a gentleman who was actually on the board of directors of the Washington Technology Center. He said, I've been hearing about this virtual retinal display. What I'd like to do is see it operating. We said, okay, come down to the lab and we'll do that. So at the time, we're using Kustal optical modulators and in order to do scanning. And this was a monochrome display, monocular display, but the image was painted with high resolution on your retina.
Uh-huh.
And it was remarkable. But it was just one eye.
Oh.
So we invited him down to the lab. You know, we were just using one eye at the time. This is a monocular system, an optical bench. And so he came down to the lab, and he sat down in front of the optical bench and looked into our objective lens of this. And sure enough, saw this virtual image. And he said, wow, this is really amazing. And really high resolution, high luminance. And we said, yeah, well, take off your spectacles. And he took off his spectacles and he said, well, I could see it just as clearly without my spectacles. And we said, yeah, we're not really using the optical power of your glasses or the lens of your eye. It's, you know, basically we're writing almost like directly on the retina.
Wow, but don't you, wouldn't you still have to take into account whether the person was nearsighted or farsighted?
No.
That doesn't,
no,
wow.
It okay. doesn't matter. And so it's clear. I mean, the image is just as clear because you basically have a beam, a non-diverging beam of light that's collimated, mm-hmm. and it goes right to the retina. So he was seeing this clearly as we do. I mean, all the other people that were working with the virtual retinal display, but then he did something else. He then switched to his left eye and started looking with his left eye into this, mm-hmm. just on his own. And his mouth dropped open. And he said, wait a minute, what are you doing here? We said, well, what do you mean? He says, I can see this with my blind eye. We said, what? He says, I'm blind in my left eye, and I can see that image. And we said, what? And so he said, yeah, I've been in an automobile accident and it blinded my eye because there's all the scar tissue in my eye and I'm seeing this image. And we said, oh yeah. And so after that, we went to the Department of Ophthalmology at the university in the medical school and said, this is what happened. And they started sending us patients. And sure enough, these patients that had, especially had optical problems in their eyes, were able to see with the virtual retinal display. And then we started finding out that people even with degenerative diseases of the retina were able to see better, you know, with age-related macular degeneration. And even when they thought the receptors were dead, we were getting light into those receptors.
Oh, my goodness.
And we found out later is the fact that we're using coherent light, the receptors act like waveguides. And that the coupling efficiency of our coherent light, which is much greater than what you could get from broadband light, non-coherent light. And so they were actually seeing. And so what this did, again, by accident, just like the dentists, it just took us off in another direction where we started working on low vision and low vision aids. And we wrote up a proposal and got some money from the National Science Foundation to work on this. So it's one of these journeys I've taken, and this has been true all the way through, where you stumble over something that you were going in another direction, but you stumbled on something. And that became more interesting than the direction you were taking initially.
Well, that is amazing and exciting stuff. I can actually see how coherent light could actually go down the waveguides that you were mentioned, whereas broadband light wouldn't be able to do that. And so that's kind of what happened. Yeah, how about that? Well, Tom, I want to have you back for one more podcast. We want to talk about things like the Rat Lab and its relationship to Skunk Works.
Uh-huh. Right.
Because they're both about deplorable animals. No, the Rat Lab means rocket and thinking.
That's right.
But it's one of Dr. Furdess's incubators for virtual reality business. Talk about the Virtual World Society, the AAR Toolworks Incorporated. I want to talk about your other NASDAQ company and then see what you have in mind for the future of VR.
Okay.
So we'll do that next on Mind Matters News. We've been talking to Dr. Tom Furness of the University of Washington, the grandfather of virtual reality, who continues to be an innovator in the field of virtual reality, as we've heard today. So until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.